I had knelt beside it and was reaching toward it when, as though a veil had been snatched away, I realized that my hand, which I had thought still several spans from the needle-like point of the nearest leaf, was about to be impaled. I drew it back hurriedly. The plant seemed almost out of reach. Indeed, I was not certain I could touch its stem even by lying prone. The temptation to use my sword was very great, but I felt it would disgrace me before Aegia and Dorcas to do so, and I knew I would have to handle the plant during the combat in any case. I advanced my hand again, cautiously, this time keeping my forearm in contact with the ground, and discovered that though I had to press my shoulder against the grass as well to prevent my upper arm from being stabbed by the lowest leaves, I could touch the stem quite readily. A point that appeared to be half a cubit from my face trembled with my breath. It was while I was snapping off the stem, no easy task, that I saw the reason only the short, soft grass flourished beneath the Averns. One of the leaves of the plant I was breaking had cut half through a blade of coarse marsh grass, and the entire grass plant, almost an L across, had begun to wither. Once picked, the plant was an enormous nuisance, as I ought to have anticipated. It would plainly have been impossible to carry it in Hildegrin's boat, as it was, without killing one or more of us, so before we re-embarked, I had to climb the slope and cut a sapling. When the twigs had been lopped, Aegia and I bound the Averne to one end of its spindly trunk, so that, as we made our way through the city later, I appeared to be bearing some grotesque standard. Then Aegia explained the use of the plant as a weapon, and I broke a second plant, although she objected, and at even greater risk, I fear, than before, since I was somewhat too confident, and practiced what she had told me. The Averne is not, as I had assumed, merely a viper-toothed mace. Its leaves can be detached by twisting them between the thumb and forefinger in such a way that the hand does not contact the edges or the point. The leaf is then, in effect, a handleless blade, envenomed and razor-sharp, ready to throw. The fighter holds the plant in his left hand by the base of the stem and plucks the lower leaves to throw with his right. Aegia cautioned me, however, to keep my own plant out of my opponent's reach, since as the leaves are removed, an area of bare stem appears, and this he might grasp and use to wrest my plant from me. When I flourished the second plant and practiced striking out with it and picking and throwing the leaves, I found that my own Averne was likely to be almost as great a danger to me as the Septentrion's. If I held it near me, there was a grave risk of pricking my arm or chest with the long lower leaves, and the flower, with its swirling pattern, held my gaze whenever I glanced down to tear off a leaf, and with the dry lust of death sought to draw me to it. All this seemed unpleasant enough, but when I had learned to keep my eyes away from the half-closed blossom, I reflected that my opponent would be exposed to the same dangers. Throwing the leaves was easier than I had supposed. Their surfaces were glossy, like the leaves of many of the plants I had seen in the jungle garden, so that they left the fingers readily, and they were heavy enough to fly far and true. They could be thrown point foremost like any knife, or made to spin in flight to cut down anything in their path with their deadly edges. I was eager, of course, to question Hildegrin about Vodalus, but no opportunity to do so came until he had rowed us back across the silent lake. Then for a moment Aegia became so intent on driving Dorcas away that I was able to draw him to one side and whisper that I, too, was a friend to Vodalus.
"You've mistaken me, young sir, for somebody else. Do you refer to Vodalus the outlaw?"
"I never forget a voice," I told him,
"or anything else."
And then in my eagerness, I impulsively added what was perhaps the worst thing I could have said.
"You tried to brain me with your shovel."
His face became mask-like at once, and he stepped back into his boat and rowed out onto the brown water. When Aegia and I left the botanic gardens, Dorcas was still with us. Aegia was anxious to make her go away, and for a time I permitted her to try. I was moved, in part, by the fear that with Dorcas near, it would be impossible for me to persuade Aegia to lie with me, but even more by a vague appreciation of the pain Dorcas would feel, lost and dismayed, as she was already, if she should see me die. Only a short time before, I had poured out to Aegia all my sorrow at the death of Thecla. Now these new concerns had replaced it, and I found I had poured it out indeed as a man might spill sour wine on the ground. By the use of the language of sorrow, I had for the time being obliterated my sorrow, So powerful is the charm of words which for us reduces to manageable entities all the passions that would otherwise madden and destroy us. Whatever my motives may have been, and whatever ages may have been, and whatever Dorcas's may have been for following us, nothing Asia did succeeded. And in the end I threatened to strike her if she did not desist, and called to Dorcas, who was then 50 paces or so behind us. After that, we three trudged along in silence, drawing many strange looks. I was soaked to soddenness, and no longer cared whether my mantle covered my fuligin torturer's cloak. Aja, in her torn brocade, must have looked nearly as strange as I. Dorcas was still smeared with mud. It dried on her in the warm spring wind that now wrapped the city, caking in her golden hair and leaving smears of powdery brown on her pale skin. Above us the Avern brooded like a gonfalon. From it there drifted a myrrhic perfume. The half-closed flower still shone as white as bone, but its leaves looked nearly black in the sunlight. Chapter 25. The Inn of Lost Loves. It has been my good fortune, or evil fortune as it may be, that the places with which my life has been largely associated have been, with very few exceptions, of the most permanent character. I might tomorrow, if I wished, return to the Citadel, and, I think, to the very cot on which I slept as an apprentice. Gyal still rolls past my city of Nessus. The botanic gardens still glitter in the sun, faceted with those strange enclosures wherein a single mood is preserved for all time. When I think of the ephemera of my life, they are likely to be men and women. But there are a few houses as well, and first among these stands the inn at the margin of the sanguinary field. We had walked away the afternoon down broad avenues and up narrow byways, and always the buildings that hemmed us round were of stone and brick. At last we came to grounds that seemed no grounds at all, for there was no exalted villa at their center. I remember I warned Aja that a storm was brewing. I could feel the closeness of the air, and I saw a line of bitter black along the horizon. She laughed at me. "What you see and what you feel, too, is nothing more than the city wall. It's always like this here. The wall impedes the movement of the air."
"That line of dark? It goes halfway to the sky."
Aja laughed again, but Dorcas pressed herself against me.
"I am afraid, Severian."
Aja heard her.
"Of the wall?"
"It won't hurt you unless it falls on you, and it has stood through a dozen ages." I looked questioningly at her, and she added, "At least it looks that old, and it may be older, who knows?"
"It could wall out the world. Does it stretch completely around the city?"
"By definition. The city is what is enclosed, though there's open country to the north, so I've heard, and leagues of ruins in the south where no one lives. But now look between those poplars. Do you see the inn?"
I did not, and said so.
"Under the tree. You've promised me a meal, and that's where I want it. We should just have time to eat before you have to meet the Septentrion."
"Not now," I said. "I'll be happy to feed you when my duel is over. I'll make the arrangements now, if you like."
I could still find no building, but I had come to see that there was something strange about the tree. A stair of rustic wood twined up the trunk.
"Do so. If you're killed, I'll invite the Septentrion. Or if he won't come, that broken sailor who is forever inviting me. We'll drink to you."
A light kindled high in the branches of the tree, and now I saw that a path led up to the stair. Before it, a painted sign showed a weeping woman dragging a bloody sword. A monstrously fat man in an apron stepped out of the shadow and stood beside it, rubbing his hands while he waited our coming. Faintly now, I could hear the clinking of pots.
"Aberne, at your command,"
said the fat man when we reached him.
"What is your wish?"
I noticed he kept a nervous eye on my Avern.
"We'll have dinner for two, to be served at..." I looked at Aja.
"The new watch."
"Good, good. But it cannot be so soon, sir. It will take longer to prepare. Unless you'll settle for cold meats, a salad, and a bottle of wine."
Aja looked impatient.
"We'll have a roast fowl, a young one."
"As you wish. I'll have the cook begin his preparations now, and you can amuse yourselves with baked stuff after the seer's victory, until the bird is done."
Aja nodded, and a look flashed between the two that made me feel certain they had met previously.
"Meanwhile,"
the innkeeper continued,
If you've yet time, I could provide a basin of warm water and a sponge for this other young lady, and perhaps you might all enjoy a glass of Medoc and some biscuits.
I was suddenly conscious of having fasted since my breakfast at dawn with Baldanders and Dr. Talos, and conscious, too, that Aegia and Dorcas might have had nothing all day. When I nodded, the innkeeper conducted us up the broad rustic stair. The trunk it circled was a full 10 paces around.
Have you visited us before, sir?
I shook my head. I was about to ask you what manner of inn this is. I've never seen anything like it.
Nor will you, sir, except here. But you ought to have come before. We keep a famous kitchen, and dining in the open air gives one the best appetite.
I thought that it must indeed, if he maintained such a girth in a place where every room was reached by steps, but I kept the reflection to myself.
The law, you see, sir, forbids all buildings so near the wall. We are permitted, having neither walls nor a roof. Those who attend the sanguinary field come here, the famous combatants and heroes, the spectators and physicians, even the ephors. Here's your chamber now.
It was a circular and perfectly level platform. Around and above it, pale green foliage shut out sight and sound. Aegia sat in a canvas chair, and I, very tired, I confess, threw myself down beside Dorcas on a couch made of leather and the linked horns of leechweeds and waterbucks. When I had laid the avern behind it, I drew Terminus Est and began to clean her blade. A scullion brought water and a sponge for Dorcas, and when she saw what I was doing, rags and oil for me. I was soon tapping in the pommel so I could strip the blade from its furniture for a real cleaning.
"Can't you wash yourself?" Aegia asked Dorcas.
"I'd like a bath, yes, but not with you watching me."
"Severian will turn his head if you ask him. He did very well in a place where we were this morning."
"And you, madam?" Dorcas said softly. "I'd rather you didn't watch. I'd like a private place if I might have one."
Aegia smiled at that, but I called the scullion again and gave her an orichalk to bring a folding screen. When it was set up, I told Dorcas I would buy her a gown if there was one to be had at the inn.
"No,"
she said. In a whisper, I asked Aegia what she thought was the matter with her. "She likes what she has, clearly. I must walk with a hand up to hold my bodice if I wouldn't be shamed for life." She let her hand fall so that her high breasts gleamed in the dying sunlight. "But those rags let her show just leg and chest enough. There's a rent at the groin, too, though I dare say you haven't noticed it." The innkeeper interrupted us, leading in a waiter who carried a plate of pastries, a bottle, and glasses. I explained that my clothing was wet, and he had a brazier brought in, then proceeded to warm himself by it, for all the world as if he stood in his private apartment.
"Feels good this time of year," he said. "The sun's dead and don't know it yet, but we do. If you're killed, you'll get to miss next winter. And if you're hurt bad, you'll get to stay inside. That's what I always tell them. Of course, most of the fights are around Midsummer's Eve, so it's more appropriate then, so to speak. I don't know if it comforts them or not, but it does no harm."
I took off the brown mantle and my gilded cloak, put my boots on a stool near the brazier, and stood beside him to dry my breeches and hose, asking if all those who came this way on Monocamy stopped to refresh themselves with him. Like every man who feels himself likely to die, I would have been happy to know that I was taking part in some established tradition.
Oh, no, he said. May moderation and St. Armand bless you, sir. If everyone who came tarried at my inn, why, it wouldn't be my inn. I'd have sold it and be living comfortable in a big stone house with Atroxes at the door and a few young fellows with knives hanging about me to settle my enemies. No, there's many a one goes by here without a glance, never thinking that when he comes past next time it may be too late to drink my wine.
Speaking of which, said Aegia, and handed me a glass. It was full to the brim with a dark crimson vintage, not a good wine, perhaps. It made my tongue prickle, and carried with its delicious taste something of harshness. But a wonderful wine, a wine better than good, in the mouth of someone as fatigued and cold as I. Aegia held a full glass of her own, but I saw by her flaming cheeks and sparkling eyes that she had already downed one other, at least. I told her to save something for Dorcas, and she said, "That milk and water virgin? She won't drink it. And it's you who'll need courage, not she." Not quite honestly, I said I was not afraid. The innkeeper exclaimed,
"That's the way! Don't you be feared, and don't fill your head with no noble thoughts about death and last days and all that.
The ones that do is the ones that never come back, you may be sure. Now, you was going to order a meal, I think, for you and your two young women afterward?
We have ordered it, I said.
Ordered, but not paid nothing toward. That was my meaning. Also, there's the wine in these here gâteaux sec. Those must be paid for here and now, as they're eaten here and now, and drank up, too. For the dinner, I'll require a deposit of 3 artichokes, with 2 more to be paid when you come to eat it.
And if I don't come?
Then there's no more charge, sir. That's how I'm able to offer my dinners at such low prices.
The man's complete insensibility disarmed me. I handed over the money, and he left us. Aja peeped around the side of the screen, behind which Dorcas was cleansing herself with the aid of the scullion, and I sat down again on the couch and took a pastry to go with what remained of my wine. If we could make the hinges in this thing lock, Severian, we might enjoy ourselves for a few moments without interruption. We could put a chair against it. But no doubt those two would choose the worst possible moment to squall and knock everything over. I was about to make some bantering reply when I noticed a scrap of paper, folded many times, that had been put beneath the waiter's tray in such a fashion that it could be seen only by someone sitting where I was.
"This is really too much," I said. "A challenge, and now the mysterious note."
Aja came to look. "What are you talking about? Are you drunk already?" I put my hand on the rounded fullness of her hip, and when she made no objection, used that pleasant handle to draw her toward me until she could see the paper.
"What do you suppose it says?" "The Commonwealth has need of you. Ride at once. Your friend is he who shall say to you, Camarilla, beware of the man with pink hair."
Falling in with the joke, Aja offered, "Come when you hear 3 pebbles tap the window."
The leaves, I should say, here.
"The rose hath stabbed the iris, who nectar affords..."
That's your Averne killing me, clearly.
"You will know your true love by her red poniard.